Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
Well, today we begin a new sermon series for this term, and I thought I would introduce the series just by having a little quiz about the Gospels. So we'll start with a couple of very easy questions just to lull you into a false sense of security that you'll know the answers. So, very, very simple first question. How many Gospels are there in the New Testament? Four. Are we right? Yeah, absolutely. Well done. And what are the names of the four Gospel writers? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Yep, you got that one right as well. Now, the questions get a bit harder now. Now, three of those are sometimes grouped together, and their Gospels are called the Synoptic Gospels. You may never have heard that word before, in which case, a little bit of education coming. So, Synoptic Gospels. So, let's sort of get three questions out of that. Number one, which are the three Gospels that are called the Synoptic Gospels? What does the word Gospel mean, and what does the word Synoptic mean, so that we can understand what we're talking about when we're talking about the Synoptic Gospels? So, Matthew, Mark, and Luke we have as an answer. Let's try that as the first question. So what are the three Gospels? They are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Simple one, then. What does the word Gospel mean? You should all know the answer to that. It means good news. That's right. So what does the word Synoptic mean? The Synoptic Gospels. Anyone want to venture an answer to that question? What does that word mean? Mr. Landry, you've got a degree in theology. You're cheating if you're answering. Let someone else answer. Give someone else a chance. Yes. All happening at the same time. That's very, very close, Liz. Well done. It's that sense of optic is about seeing. The word syn means doing things together. So synergy is when things work together. So it's seeing together. It's looking at things from the same point of view. And so there are three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and when you read those Gospels, they all look at the same story from the same perspective. They have a very similar feel to them. They all look at the Gospel, they all tell the good news from the same basic perspective. But John is different. He stands out as being different from the other Gospels. He isn't one of the Synoptic Gospels. His Gospel has a very different feel to it. When you read John's Gospel, it feels different from the other Gospels. Now, I said the questions got harder, so if you thought that one was hard, let's try this one. Now, this one, I'm going to encourage you to talk to one another. And you can use whatever electronic devices you have on your person to find the answer to this question. In church tradition, each of the four Gospels has had a particular symbol associated with it, an image or a picture that is associated with each of the four Gospels. What are those four pictures or images that are associated with each of the four Gospels? So why don't you talk to one another, see if other people around you know the answer, and genuinely use whatever technology you have at your disposal, use your tablet, your phone, and see if together you can come up with the answer to that question. What are the four images that people use? Now, it has just been pointed out to me that the answer is contained within the windows of this building. I did not know that until now. The answer is contained in the windows of this building. And in Google. So, who's Googled it? Who's come up? Let's take it one at a time. What is the symbol that is associated with Matthew's gospel? Okay, we have two answers here, an angel or a winged man. And because that's almost one and the same thing, that's right. So that's somebody else's stained glass window. St. Matthew is portrayed as a winged man very often. What is the symbol that is often associated with Mark's gospel? A lion, a winged lion. Let's have that one up. So Mark's gospel is often used this symbol of a winged lion. What is the symbol for Luke's gospel? An ox or a bull. A winged ox or a winged bull is often used as the symbol. Yep, so we got that one right. Luke's gospel. And what is the symbol for John's gospel? It is an eagle. So we have the final window there of John's gospel as an eagle. And someone has pointed out these four windows up here. I had never noticed this until today. If you're sitting underneath them, you can't see. I'm sorry. You'll need to look later. But if you look up here, you can see this window here as a winged man. And then we have a winged lion, a winged bull, and the eagle. So those four windows represent the four gospels. I did not know they were there. Thank you for pointing that out to me. The answers were there all along. Now, people have their different opinions about why these symbols were chosen. And if you Googled it, if you read the articles, you would find different ideas presented. But almost everybody agrees that the reason why the eagle was chosen as the symbol for John's gospel is because the eagle is seen as the bird that flies higher than many other birds. It soars to loftier heights than the other birds. And people have thought that's what John's gospel is like. There's something about John in his gospel that soars to loftier heights. And I don't know whether you noticed that the sort of the image that was on the screen earlier in the service between the songs or when there was nothing that needed to be on the screen and we just put a picture up was actually a picture of an eagle in flight flying towards, there it is, chosen specially for this sermon series to have there all the time, the eagle soaring higher than the other birds. And so you've probably guessed that it's John's gospel that we're going to be focusing on. And so we've already found out a couple of things about John's gospel. So just to give you a little easy way of remembering things about John's gospel, we've already said that the synoptic gospels are different. They were all written probably before John, so John was the last gospel to be written. So we can say about John's gospel, it was the last one of the four gospels to be written. We've already said that like the eagle, it soars to loftier heights. So let's use that and use an L. It is a gospel with loftier themes. It has these higher themes than the other gospels. But we can also say about John, a third characteristic, there are other things we could say, but this is just three to give you a little bit of a flavor for John's gospel. John's gospel contains long teaching sections. It's quite different from the other Gospels. Matthew and Mark tell a lot of the parables of Jesus. They're the stories that Jesus told, and they contain them very often in short sections. But when you get to John, you don't have the same type of parables. You don't have the stories that you get in the Synoptic Gospels. What you get in John is very much more this emphasis on themes and presented in big chunks. And so the biggest chunk of all is John 14, 15, and 16, three chapters worth of solid teaching by Jesus. So John is characterized by these long teaching sections that cover major themes. And so some of the themes that emerge out of John are themes such as truth, or glory, or light, or life, or love. There is a whole range of themes that emerge in John's gospel. And so if you have at all checked our directory for the term, I don't know whether you were aware that we produce this. Every term we produce this. And every term someone says to us something like, wouldn't it be really helpful if we had a list of all the staff members and their phone numbers? It would be really helpful if we had that, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be really helpful if we published a list of all the major events that are going to happen in the term? Wouldn't it be so helpful if we did it? Wouldn't it be helpful? Yes, it would. That's why we do it. And so if you've looked at it, you'll see that for the Sundays in the evening services, are we going to be doing a series on the themes in John's gospel, those big themes that we've identified. But we're also going to be looking at John in the morning services, but we're going to be looking at it from a slightly different angle in the mornings. And so the benefit of that is if you choose to come morning and evening, you will get a completely different outlook on John's gospel. So you can look at it from two different perspectives. So the evening we're looking at the themes, but in the morning we're going to do it a little differently. All of the Gospels tell the stories of the amazing things that Jesus did, how he healed the sick, how he raised the dead, how he fed the 5,000. All of the Gospels contain those same stories. What is interesting is this, that Matthew, Mark, and Luke tend to refer to them as the miracles of Jesus. But John speaks about them in a different way. John says these are the signs. And the thing about a sign is that it's pointing to something else. And so John gives us a different perspective on the things that Jesus did by calling them the signs that Jesus did. And so here in the morning services, we're going to be looking at the signs that Jesus did. There are seven of them in the Gospels, and we're going to look at them over the next few weeks. And again, you'll see that in the program if you've looked at that. So whether it's the morning or the evening, we're looking at John. In the evening, we'll be looking at the themes in John, and in the morning, we're going to be looking at the signs in John's Gospel. One other thing by way of general introduction to the gospel before we have our Bible reading, and then I'll start preaching. This does not count as part of my sermon time. Just want you to know that. This is just general helpful introduction before we get to the sermon. So, final introductory thing about John's gospel. Why did John write his gospel? And I'm not asking you to guess, because there is actually a passage in John where he tells us the answer to that question. He tells us why he wrote his gospel. So that's again a quick question for you to talk to your neighbors about and maybe even open a Bible and look and see. Who can identify for us the passage in John's gospel where he tells us why he wrote his gospel? If you haven't got a Bible and you'd like one, please feel free to raise a hand and our wonderful hospitality team will come and give you a Bible, and then you'll have it in a few moments' time when we get to our Bible reading as well. So somewhere in the gospel of John, John himself tells us why he wrote his gospel. I'll give you a clue. It's not near the beginning of the gospel, so don't start at John chapter 1 and start reading through, because you'll be reading for a long time. You might want to start closer to the end of John's gospel, not quite the last chapter, shall we say, but somewhere in there you might find the answer to the question, why did John write his gospel? So assuming now that everyone's got a Bible, if a hand goes up, I will assume it's because you've got the answer to the question rather than because you're asking for a Bible. So who has been able to find where is it in John's gospel that John tells us why he wrote his gospel? Anyone found it? Pam? John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Is that the right answer? Let's check that out. That is absolutely the right answer. Well done. So let's look at those verses. Let's just put them up on the screen, because John says here, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So that's John telling us why he wrote his gospel. And these two verses bring together the two series that we're looking at in the morning and the evening, because John speaks about the signs that Jesus performed and the fact that there were far more than are mentioned in the gospels. But these particular ones, these are written so that we might believe. And John mentions some of the major themes of the gospel again, the themes about believing in Jesus and Jesus as the Son of God and the theme of life. And he pulls it all together right at the end by saying the reason he wrote the gospel was so that his readers, so that we and other people like us might come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. But even that isn't actually the full reason. It's not the full reason he wrote. The main reason then is that he says so that by believing you may have life in his name. And so that's the title we've given to this term's sermon series, both in the morning and the evening, the title, Life in His Name. That was the purpose for which John wrote his gospel, so that people could come to see who Jesus is and believe in him, and that by believing in him, they might have life in his name. And so our hope and prayer is that as we look together into this gospel this term, people will come to believe in Jesus for the first time and receive life in his name. And that all of us who already believe in Jesus will find out more of what it means to have life in his name. And so with that by way of introduction, we now come to our passage for today, which is the first part of John's gospel, John chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. You'll find it on page 1004 of your church Bibles, and Anne is going to come and read that for us now. John chapter 1, verses 1 to 18, page 1004. Thank you.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.' Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God, and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known."
Thank you. As many of you know, a couple of years ago, one of our daughters, along with our son-in-law and three of our grandchildren, moved to live in the United States. And last summer, they paid a visit back to the UK. And they brought with them a girl called Hope, who is a friend of one of our granddaughters. Now, Hope had never been to the UK before. This was her very first visit to the UK. But her mother, Hope's mother, had visited the UK many years ago when she was a teenager. And on that particular visit, her mother had visited the Tower of London to see the crown jewels. And so top of the list of things that Hope wanted to do, when we said to Hope on her very first day, "Where do you want to go?" her answer was, "My mum says I've got to go to the Tower of London and see the crown jewels." And so we set off with family and with Hope, and we got to see the Tower of London. Now, of course, the crown jewels, which are contained within the Tower of London, are a very, very popular thing to go and see. And so there are nearly always long queues outside the building. I'm told that on one occasion, an American tourist actually complained to one of the officials at the Tower of London about the length of time spent in the queue. And he received this answer, as the official said to him, "Sir, we don't think of it as a queue. We think of it as an experience of anticipation." And so on the day that we went to the Tower of London, we joined the experience of anticipation And to make the experience of anticipation more interesting, along the route where we were experiencing anticipation, there were various signs or posters and photographs along the way telling us, showing us something of the crown jewels that we would see when we got into the building. So to make it more interesting, we were presented with this portrayal of signposts and signs that said, when you get in, this is what you will see. And we experienced anticipation until eventually we arrived at the door of the building, and over the door of the building, just as we went in, was the last sign of all, which simply said, the crown jewels. And we knew at that moment we were now going to enter in, and from that point on, we would not just be seeing the signs, we would be seeing the reality. Now that passage that Anne just read for us, John chapter 1, verses 1 to 18, John's introduction, or sometimes called the prologue to his gospel. Reading that passage is rather like being in the queue waiting to look at the crown jewels. Because in these 18 verses, John gives us glimpse after glimpse after glimpse, like posters or signposts of the things that we're going to see when we get into the gospel itself. It's as if in this passage, he's giving us almost a summary of everything that is going to come up later in the gospel. And they're little glimpses, signposts along the way of what is going to be in the gospel when we get into it. So this morning, just for the last few moments that we've got, let's join the queue and have a quick look at some of those signposts, those posters that John gives us. And as we join the queue, the first poster we come to, telling us a little bit of what we're going to see when we get into the gospel, is the poster that says, in the beginning. And no Jewish person could write that phrase or read that phrase without immediately recognizing those words as words that they'd read somewhere before. Where had they read those words before? Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. They are the words with which the Bible begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so for John to begin his gospel with these words is saying, the story that you are about to read, as you read the rest of this book, the story that you are about to read is a story that goes right back to the dawn of time. It is not a story that is beginning now. It is actually the fulfillment and the completion of a story that began centuries, decades, millennia ago, right at the dawn of time. It goes right back to the creation of the world. The story of Jesus continues and completes the story begun in Genesis 1. The story of a God who creates, who wants to have a relationship with creation, even when that creation turns against him. It's a story that goes right back to the beginning of time. But the queue moves quickly, and we move past that, and we get to another sign. And this one says, in the beginning was the Word. And the next sign is the Word. And we're still back in Genesis chapter 1, because when we get to Genesis chapter 1, what is the phrase that is there again and again and again? It is this, and God said, and God said, and God said. How did God create the world? The Bible gives us this answer: God spoke, and it was created. He spoke it into being. It was by the word of God. Psalm 33 picks up the same theme and tells us, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made. Hebrews 11, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. God spoke, and it was created. It was the word. And so John's Jewish readers would have picked this up and seen again, this is a reference back, that this story is not just about the creation, it's about the creator. It's about the one who first spoke the word and this world came into being. This is a story that doesn't just go back to the dawn of time. It's a story that is about the creator himself. But not all John's readers were Jewish. Some of them would have been Greek. And as Greeks, they would have perhaps been familiar with the fact that their Greek philosophers had also spoken about the word, the logos. Because in Greek philosophy, the logos, the word, was seen as a divine principle that gives life to the world. And you can almost sense the excitement in John's voice as he writes this, as he's saying to his readers, these are the signs, don't you see, don't you understand? Everything that you Jews have believed about how God created the world and everything that you Greeks have thought about how the world is held together, you're going to find out about all of that in this story. Because it all comes together in one person, the person of Jesus. Because the Word is a person. The Word is Jesus. Jesus, who was with God and is God and was with God in the beginning, the one through whom all things were made. This story that you're going to get into in John's Gospel is the story about the Word who created all things. And again, the cue moves on, and we get to the next sign, and the next sign says, in him was life. And we're still back in Genesis. Because in Genesis 2, we read the account of the creation of humanity, where the Lord God created, formed a man from the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And John is telling us that in his gospel, he's going to introduce us to the one who is the source of all life. He is the one who first gave life to humanity, who breathed into humanity and gave us life. He's going to introduce us to the one who is the life, the one who gives life, the one who will one day stand next to Martha as she is standing by the graveside of her brother Lazarus, who has just died, and will say to her, Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. And by raising Lazarus from the dead, will give evidence of his ability not just to give life physically, but that being a sign of the fact that he can give life spiritually. But that's a sermon for later. The one who will say to Thomas, Thomas, I am the way and the truth and the life. The one who will say to his disciples, I've come that they might have life and have it to the full. The one about whom John says at the end that if you believe in him, you will have life in his name. John here at the beginning is just giving us this signpost. If you keep reading, if you look into this gospel, you will discover the one who is the life giver. But the cue moves on. It's moving quite quickly today, this cue. The cue moves on. And we get to another poster, and this one says about the light of all people. We're still back in Genesis 1, really. Because when we see that the phrase that is repeated again and again is, and God said, what was the very first thing that God said recorded in Genesis chapter 1? Let there be light. And there was light. And God separated the light from the darkness. And so John is giving us a glimpse that he's going to introduce us in this gospel to the one who will say, I am the light of the world. He's going to introduce us to the one who brings light into the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome it. And John is saying here, as you read this gospel, you will discover someone who will bring light into your life, who by bringing light into your life will dispel the darkness from your life, who will bring light into your life that no matter what darkness comes against you, it will not overcome the light. You will have light in your life that darkness cannot conquer. And the cue moves on, and suddenly we find ourselves at the door itself, ready to go in. And over the door, just before we go in to the gospel itself, that final sign that says, as it were, the crown jewels. What's the final sign over the door before we enter the gospel? Well, it's John chapter 1, verse 14. The final sign is this, where John says, as you get into this gospel, what you will see is this: the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. That's what you're going to see in this gospel. That's where it's all headed. This is where the story is headed. This is the big story that John's gospel is going to tell us, that the one who was there in the beginning, the one through whom the world was created, the one who breathed life into humanity, the one who gives light that dispels darkness, this one became flesh. He became a human being, and as John says, he made his dwelling among us. And the literal meaning of that phrase, the Greek phrase there is this: he became flesh and he pitched his tent among us. And what would his first readers have thought of when they heard those words, he pitched his tent? No, they would not have thought of a muddy field in Shepton Mallet and a New Wine Conference where we pitch our tents. And they would not have broken out into a cold sweat at the thought of camping, because for them the word tent did not take them to campsites and New Wine Conferences. For them, the word tent would have taken them again back into the Old Testament, not now to the book of Genesis, but to the book of Exodus. Because when the people of Israel were traveling on their way from slavery in Egypt through the wilderness to the promised land, God commanded them to do something. He said, I want you to construct a tent. And he promised that that tent would be the symbol of his presence among his people. As he said, this is where I will come and I will dwell among you. I will live among you. And so the tent in the Old Testament was the symbol of God living among his people. And John is telling us here, in this story that you are about to read, when you get into the rest of the gospel, you will hear the story how once again God himself has come and lived on earth among us in the person of his son Jesus, who became flesh and pitched his tent among us. God has come to live among us. But even then, the story isn't over, because if you go back to the book of Exodus, when we read the account in the book of Exodus of how they constructed the tent, or the tabernacle, as it's often referred to, tabernacle is just the Latin word for tent, so let's use English word, as they constructed the tent, we get to the end of Exodus chapter 40, and we read that when it was finally completed, the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Back in John 1, John tells us that when the Word became flesh and pitched his tent among us, we have seen his glory. The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. In the person of Jesus, the Word made flesh and living among us, John says, we see the glory of God. In other words, we see what God is really like. That's what the story is going to tell us. That's the purpose of the story. And what is God really like? He is full of grace and truth. That's where it's all been headed. How do we know this? How do we know that that's what God is really like? Well, John answers the question in John 1:18. He says this: no one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. That's what John is going to show us in the rest of this gospel. That Jesus, who was there in the beginning, the one through whom the world was created, who breathed life into humanity and brings light into the darkness, this one, Jesus, has become one of us. He has become flesh. He has pitched his tent among us, and the glory of God has filled that tent. Jesus has lived among us so that we can see the glory of God. We can see exactly what God is like. He is full of grace and truth. So that's the introduction to John's gospel. 18 verses, the signposts along the way of what's coming in the gospel. And in the next weeks, we'll unpack it further. But as we think about just that introduction and what it's all about, let's come into land by asking the question, what difference does that make to us today? Here we are, January 2017, on the first day of a week of prayer and fasting. What does this passage have to say to us? And what can we do about it? Well, we looked at the literal meaning of the Greek phrase as Jesus, the Word, became flesh and pitched his tent among us. Let's look at another translation of the same phrase, this time Eugene Peterson's translation in The Message. Because Eugene Peterson puts it like this: the Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. I like that translation. I like The Message generally. I like that particular translation of that verse. The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. I think we can put it quite simply. God the Father wanted people to know exactly what he's like So he sent Jesus to live in the neighborhood so that people would know exactly what God is like. And then we go right to the end of John's gospel and we hear Jesus saying these words, "As the Father sent me, I'm sending you. As the Father sent me, so I'm sending you." God the Father wanted people to know exactly what he's like, so he sent Jesus to live in the neighborhood. And Jesus wants people to know exactly what he is like, so he sends us to live in the neighborhood. And those of you who've been around at St. Bees a little bit recently will probably recognize those maps, because we've used them a little bit in the last few months. You remember that from time to time over the past few months, as part of our service, we've broken you down into groups based on where you live. And we've got into neighborhood groups, postcode groups, and you've met with other people who've lived in the same neighborhood that you live in. And if you remember the last time we did that, we got into our neighborhood groups just before Christmas in the middle of December, and we prayed about our neighborhoods and what was going to be happening over Christmas. And I told you at that time that in 2017, we would be encouraging you to take that further. And so this is where we're going to take it further. Because that step further that I mentioned at the time and I want to push again now is this: we want to encourage you in 2017, and the fact that it's the part of our week of prayer and fasting makes it even more appropriate, to think about meeting up with the people who live in your neighborhood for 1 hour in one of your homes to pray about your neighborhood. Because Jesus wants people to know what he's like, so he has sent you to live in the neighborhood so that you can reveal to people what Jesus is like. And as they get to know him, they'll discover the Father who is full of grace and truth. And so as this is our week of prayer and fasting, and because you'll be fasting, you might have just a little bit more time on your hands. Why don't you think about this week starting to do that, to find other people who live in your neighborhood and getting together with them for 1 hour to pray for your neighborhood. Now, let me just give you one caveat to that, which is this: if you can only get out once in the week to pray, make sure that it's the central prayer meeting here on Wednesday. That's the priority. I said at the night that there is no unless. There probably might be one or two people who have an unless, but forget the unless, you need to be at the prayer meeting. I mean, I can't dress that up any more nicely than that. You need to be at the prayer meeting. Wednesday, 8 o'clock, will you be there? Yep. About half of you. That's good. 7:45, that's the ruse to get people there for 8 o'clock. But yes, 7:45, David's absolutely right, and we will start praying at 8 o'clock. So 7:45, if you want a cup of coffee, 8 o'clock to pray. Please be there. But if you find you have a little bit of extra time this week, in addition to being at the central prayer meeting, as part of our week of prayer and fasting, then I want to encourage you to think about getting together with people who live in your neighborhood, in one of the homes in your neighborhood, and praying for your neighborhood, just for 1 hour. I think it's very important in these things that we lead by example. And so for anyone who lives in the EN4 postcode, which is where Anne and I live, then this week on Thursday evening, the 19th of January, from 8 till 9 o'clock in the evening, we're going to be meeting in our home to pray for EN4. So if you live in EN4, that's basically the East Barnet, New Barnet area, if you live in that area and you would like to pray for East Barnet and New Barnet, then you are welcome to come to our home on Thursday evening between 8 and 9 o'clock and pray for the neighborhood. And so if you live in that area and you'd like to come along, catch Anne or myself after the service, and we'll give you the details of where we live so that you can come along. We don't expect you to have prophetic insight and find out from the Lord where we live. We will tell you where we live. But it would be so great if that happened in other places. I put this challenge to the 9:30 congregation. And a few people at the 9:30 said, yeah, they were prepared to do the same. And what we're asking is either to do it this week or to arrange this week when you're going to do it. Because if you can only be out once and it's got to be the central prayer meeting on Wednesday, then you could arrange this week with one or two others, let's say maybe next week or the week after, you will get together with them to pray. And so if you live in EN4... Anne and I are giving you the invitation for this Thursday. If you live in N14, Peter and Elizabeth Borum have said that they would love to start praying for their neighborhood. So if you live in N14, anyone living in N14? If you are interested in praying for N14, then Peter and Elizabeth Borum would love to hear from you, and I can arrange to make that contact if you get in touch with me. If you live in N3, even Alex Haddo this morning at 9:30 said they would be happy to host an hour of prayer for N3 in their home. Anyone living in N3? So if you want to pray about N3, then get in touch with even Alex Haddo. If you live in N2, Jan and Liz Kovar said they would be happy to host something in their homes. Anyone in N2? It's a bit of a minority area, but if you want to pray for N2, Jan and Liz. If you live in EN2, Andy and Sue Pritchard said they would be willing to open their home to pray. So we got some postcodes covered, but there are some that are not yet covered. So this is your opportunity to respond now. So is there anyone who lives in a different postcode who is prepared to say, either this week or this week I will arrange it, that I'm willing to have people come to my home for 1 hour to pray about my neighborhood, our neighborhood, by postcode? So we've covered EN4, N14, N3, N2, and EN2. So in one sense, those are covered, but there are other postcodes. So is there anyone who's prepared to say, yeah, I'm for that. I'm willing to pray about my neighborhood. This is the postcode I live in. And then anyone else who lives in that postcode, we can try and link you up. And the doors are locked and no one's leaving until we've got this, you know. Come on. Which postcode area are you in? N21. Anyone else in N21? Couple of folks here. Anyone who's in N21 then, you need to see Felicity to pray about the N21 area. Thanks for that, Felicity. Anyone else who's prepared? Anne? NW7. I can remember one thing at a time. Remind me, you were N21, weren't you? So I can... N21 is Felicity. NW7 is Anne. Anyone else live in NW7? It's not a very popular area, is it? What's wrong with NW7? Goodness me. Well, we'll keep that, and you can pray for your neighborhood, and we can find other people to join you. Anyone else who's prepared to say, yeah, I'm prepared to open my home? EN5, okay? So that's another Barnet area. So EN5, and this is the moment where my mind goes blank, and I do, it's Kelly, isn't it? Yes, Kelly, I did remember the name just in time. So Kelly, anyone else living in EN5 who would be willing to pray for EN5? So a couple of folks over there for EN5. You need to link up with Kelly. Kelly, do you want to just sort of stand up so people can see you? Okay, so that's Kelly, EN5. Anyone else who's prepared to say, I'm up for it?
N12.
That's a fairly significant postcode, isn't it, as we're actually based in N12. So George, and I'm assuming Tina's in agreement with that, unless she hasn't objected. Okay, so George and Tina. Anyone who lives in N12 who would be, wanted to... So you've got a good group of people here. So, George, find George afterwards and arrange to get together to pray for N12. So we've already got there a good number of people who are saying, yeah, I'm up for that. At the moment, all we're asking you to do is do this once for 1 hour. Now, what I hope is that once you've done it once for 1 hour, you will all say, that was great, shall we do it again? That's the honest hope. We want you to keep on doing it, but all we're asking at the moment is you agree to do it once for 1 hour. Will you come offering for another postcode over here? N10, that's sort of Muswell Hill area, N10. So Chris and Joe over in N10. Anyone else from N10? Someone at the back there. So you need to link up with Chris and Joe and arrange a time when you can get together to pray for the N10 area. Now, it may be that you think, I'm not up for making decisions. I don't buy things on the door and I don't make commitments in church without thinking about it. If you go away and you think about it and you think, yeah, I'd be up for that, then just drop me an email. Email address will appear on the screen in a moment. There it is. Drop me an email and I'll try and link you up with other people. Henry's getting twitchy. He's got the book and he's trying to get up here, but I haven't finished yet, Henry. I've got another couple of minutes to go. Good job I'm retiring soon, isn't it? Yeah, there we go. So, Ben, do you want to get yourselves back up? Because we might have time for a song. Why are we doing this? Why would we say, I'll pray in my home, I'll pray in my home for the neighborhood? God the Father wants people to know exactly what he's like So he sent Jesus into the neighborhood. Jesus wants people to know exactly what he's like. So he sends us into the neighborhood. So why are we doing it? We're doing it for the sake of our neighbors, those who live in our neighborhood. We're doing it for the sake of the people who live next door to us. We're doing it for the sake of our nation. With all the issues that we're facing as a nation, we need to be praying for our neighborhoods for the sake of our nation. We're doing it for the sake of the world, because we want the world to know what Jesus is like. We're doing it so that people will come to see Jesus, will believe in him, because the promise is that those who believe in him, he gives them the right to become children of God. And those who believe in him receive life in his name. That's why we're doing it.